Do you feel like there are gifts inside of you ready to burst out? Are you feeling unfulfilled and called to make a difference in a more meaningful way? Welcome to Speaking of Impact with your host, Bob DePasquale. Led by his own unique experiences and curiosity, Bob will inspire you to identify and utilize your gifts in ways that will make more of an impact on the world around you. And now, here's Bob.
Speaking of impact, this means war. I would definitely not consider myself a war expert or historian. However, I do find these topics to be fascinating. Since the dawn of time, humans have been fighting for something. I think one of the most commendable things to fight for is freedom. Everyone deserves freedom. Many of us have it, and it's infinitely valuable. And although I'm not well versed on these subjects, my curiosity allows me to present to you Steve Snyder. Steve is the author of Shot Down, a book chronicling his father's experience as a World War II fighter pilot that was shot down over Belgium. Howard Snyder spent 7 months bouncing around in Belgium trying to avoid his capture before returning to safety at an American base in England. The book is about more than just World War II, though. It's about freedom, courage, and the willingness to sacrifice. Here's today's Impact interview. Steve Snyder, welcome to Speaking of Impact. How are you today, Steve?
I'm doing great. Thanks a lot for having me on your show, Bob.
No problem. I am super excited to have you. I'm not the historian that I probably should be, that you are, but I know many of our listeners are, and I really thought your book, Shot Down, and the story of your father is just a fascinating, fascinating story. I wanted to ask you some questions about that. And we were just talking offline, you know, with full disclosure to everyone out there, this is probably our fifth attempt at getting this interview in. But that is the Impact Maker movement in a nutshell. That's what we're all about. We just push forward and we get it done here on Speaking of Impact. So Steve, your patience has been much appreciated. I do want to dive right into your expertise. Why is it so important to you to share these stories? And I know we're going to get into exactly what it's all about, but why is it so important to you to get this message out about your father and the true story of Howard Snyder and the crew of the B-17, Susan Ruth.
Well, you know, World War II ended 75 years ago, and it's fading in people's memory. And we just can't let that happen, because the brave young men who were really just boys, most of them, the courage they showed and the sacrifice they gave to save the world from tyranny and to preserve the freedoms that we enjoy today just must be told, must be kept, must be remembered. And so that's why I do what I do. Since I wrote the book, it actually changed my life. I have a new career now. I basically go, I travel all over the United States, attending air shows, signing copies of my book. I do a lot of speaking, making PowerPoint presentations to all different types of groups with the goal of, you know, just educating the public about the air war over Europe and honoring the men who fought it, and trying to get people to appreciate and realize what they did, and to appreciate the freedoms that we take for granted today, especially in younger generations that haven't gone through the hardships and trial that those guys did.
Yeah, there's definitely some meaning there that we need to make sure that the younger generations understand. And you mentioned the book changed your life. I mean, you've been on, the book's been promoted on ABC, NBC, CBS, Fox, all over the place. So when you say it changed your life, I mean, outside of that exposure, what do you mean by that?
Well, I retired from a 40-year career in sales and sales management in 2009. And that's when I had the time to really delve into my dad's history in more detail. And, you know, at the time, I was just, you know, a new retiree. I was reading a lot of books, going for walks, you know, taking naps in the afternoon, and just kind of living the life of a retiree. And then once I got into my research for the book, and then I decided to write the book and publish the book, I had no idea, you know, what what happened after that. You know, I didn't have any background as a writer or any writing training. And, you know, here I write this book, and hopefully that it would be interesting to people. But I had no idea that of the success that it would have, and that it would entail me, you know, starting to travel all around and speaking to groups. I didn't anticipate that really when I published the book and attending these air shows. And so, like I say, it's basically a part-time job. I spent hours every day promoting the book on social media. So it's really, changed my life.
You were living the retired high life per se. And then all of a sudden you became this well-known author because of the story. I mean, I think what happened there is so inspirational and just reminds us of what we have, especially in our country here in the United States. That message is super powerful. And you seem like the perfect person to share it. And, you know, I don't know why, and we may never know, but I think the way that you've been able to share it, I mean, I've looked at some of the videos and some of the historical documents that you have on your website. If you go to stevesnyderauthor.com, that's Snyder, S-N-Y-D-E-R, stevesnyderauthor.com, you can see war letters and research documentation, and you can see old entertainment and series about World War II and those sort of things. You have a passion for this. It's more than just a story. It's something that you're kind of been living for the past decade or so, huh?
Well, it definitely is my passion. It really rejuvenated me, I guess you could say. And I have a ball doing this. I really enjoy it. I travel to, you know, and see new places all the time, different cities and towns around the United States. I meet all sorts of, you know, great people. I'm privileged to meet, you know, veterans when I go to a lot of these events. So it's really, I guess, a hobby, a passion, a vocation, whatever you want to call it. But it's I'm really blessed to be able to do what I do.
Yeah, that's great. And so the Speaking of Impact podcast is really about people doing what they love and making a positive impact one way or another in the world. And people ask us all the time, Steve, is it too late? Or how do I get into this? How do I find something? I'm searching for a positive impact project. And you're a great example that you might have had passion about something for quite a while, but it just wasn't the right time in life to be able to chase that passion. And now here you are, and you're doing it all the time. You just said you're loving it. It's kind of something that just probably brings you energy and keeps you young. I think it's excellent. And the key point, though, is that it's making a positive impact. It's helping future generations learn. So I really, really commend you for that. I want to dive into the actual story and a little bit more about the book. Can you give me a little bit of a background about your father and his, you know, going into the military at that? You talked about being such a young age. I know it was a requirement at that point in our nation's history. But what did that mean to him and his life at that point?
Well, he was working for clothing, Desmond's Clothing Company in Los Angeles. Actually, after he got out of high school, he didn't go to college. He went to work. And then, the world went to war in September of 1939 when Germany invaded Poland. And then in 1940, in the fall of 1940, September, President Franklin Roosevelt implemented the first peacetime draft in U.S. history. And as a result of that, my dad, registered for the draft and went in and joined the Army in April of 1941. Mm-hmm. And then he was stationed at Fort Lewis, Washington. And then that December, on December 7th, which we just celebrated or commemorated, I should say, a couple days ago, Japan bombed Pearl Harbor and the United States was at war. So then my dad had just gotten recently married in July, the previous July, and it didn't take him too long before my mother got pregnant, and he didn't think he could support his family very well on a private's pay in the Army. as a new wife, baby on the way. And so that's why he volunteered for the Air Force to make more money, especially if he could make it through pilot training and become an officer. And that's really why he joined the Air Force as opposed to just staying in the Army. Mm-hmm. So, those events happened rapidly, not only to my dad, but all the young men in their late teens, early 20s at that time. So that thrust him into the war effort. And then he went through pilot training, which was really tough, actually. There were three main stages in pilot training: primary, basic, and advanced training before you got your pilot's wings and your commission as a second lieutenant. But 40% of the guys who started pilot training washed out because it was tough, not only physically, but mentally. They took lots of courses like meteorology and physics and so complicated college type courses to be able to become a pilot. And the guys who washed out, they either became bombardiers or navigators or gunners.
Wow. So
that really started him on his way. And then after he graduated from pilot training, then he went to transitional training where he learned how to fly a B-17 four-engine bomber, and then went to operational crew training where the various members of the crew came together and they learned to operate as a team. And then once deemed ready, they were assigned overseas to the European Theater of Operations. And on October 21st of 1943, he and his crew reported to the 306 Bomb Group at Thurlow, England, which was part of the 8th Air Force.
Wow. I mean, I can only imagine being in that stage of life and then having to go over to the other side of the world to defend the country. And then being in the Air Force too, it's a whole nother thing. I happen to be terrified of flying. I do it all the time, to be honest with you. I've traveled many places in this world. I've been very blessed myself, but there's something about being up in the air. So I can't imagine piloting a B-17. And by the way, I thought it was interesting here that, you know, you noted that the plane was named after your oldest sister, Susan Ruth, who was just one at the time. Wow, it's such a young family. What do you know about the B-17? I know nothing about planes. Like I said, I barely even want to open my eyes when I'm on a 747. So how can you describe a B-17? I mean, how fast does that thing go? How many people does it hold?
Well, the B-17, it was nicknamed the Flying Fortress because of the armament that it had on the plane. It had 12 to 13 50 caliber machine guns, so it could put out a tremendous amount of firepower.
Oh, man.
And also it could take a tremendous amount of battle damage and keep flying. And it was a revolutionary plane at the time. Most of the planes back there, you know, were fighters. World War One, we just fought with biplanes. And then all of a sudden, it was amazing how fast they made advancements in aviation to come up with this bomber that could fly faster and higher than any single engine plane at the time when it first was developed. And it had a 10-man crew. It had four officers who in the front of the plane. It was the flight crew, the bombardier, the navigator, and then two pilots. The first pilot, which was my dad, and as such, he was the commander of the plane and the crew. And then there was a co-pilot. And then in addition to the four officers, there were six enlisted men who were mainly gunners on the plane. Typically, the gunners tended to be younger in their late teens, 18, 19. And the flight crew, the officers, tended to be in their early 20s. Actually, my dad was an old guy. He was 28 years old when he went overseas. So they called him Grandpa, the old man, you know, at 28 years old.
Wow.
It was a tremendous a bomber, actually, in the European Theater of Operations. There were two bombers, or should I call heavy bombers, four-engine bombers. One was the B-17 Flying Fortress, and the other was the B-24 Liberator. And there's always lots of, conversation or a debate on which one was the better one. Since I'm partial to the B-17, of course, since my dad flew one. Sure. But they both were engaged in combat missions that were just brutal over Europe, occupied Europe and Germany. There were three different types of, or models, I should say, of B-17s that were flown in Europe. One was the E model, but they only built about 500 of those, so they were quickly phased out by the next model called the F model. And then the F model was phased out in October of 1943 by really the definitive B-17 model, the G model. And you can always tell the G model because it has a chin turret underneath the nose of the plane.
I'm sorry, it has a what?
You can identify a G model because it has a nose turret. Two 50 caliber machine guns and a nose turret, and a chin turret that's underneath the nose of the plane.
Wow. And they call this thing the Flying Fortress. I'm picturing this, this massive plane flying through the air that the enemy's firing at. But unfortunately, they were shot down over Belgium. So as strong as that plane was, they must have been under quite an attack that day.
Yes. At the beginning of the war, the 8th Air Force flew its first mission on August 17th of 1942. 8th Bomber Command thought that these heavily armed bombers flying in these tight formations of hundreds of bombers at a time could defend themselves from the German Air Force, the Luftwaffe. But sadly, in the early years of the war in 42, especially in 43, that was not the case. These bomber formations could not defend themselves from the Luftwaffe. They took devastating losses, especially in 1943. A mission limit was implemented in April of 1943. So these bomber combat crews could have some hope that they could make it home prior to implementing a mission limit of 25. The bomber crew's morale was going in the tank because they realized they'd never make it home. With no mission limits, they'd either be killed or shot down and become prisoners of war. But even though they implemented that 25 mission limit in 1943, it was statistically impossible to complete 25 missions. The average number of missions flown before being shot down was only 6.
Wow.
And actually, the losses culminated in the fall of 1943 in what was known as Black Week, when over 4 missions, the 8th Air Force lost 148 bombers. That's almost 1,500 men. The worst day was Thursday, October 14th, called Black Thursday, when they sent 291 B-17s to bomb the ball bearing factories at Schweinfurt, Germany, and 60 of them were shot down. So in one day, 600 men were lost. And the 8th Air Force was in shock after that. They considered discontinuing daylight bombing, because there was no way they could sustain those losses. It wasn't until right at the end of 43, the beginning of 44, and the introduction of the P-51 Mustang, that these bomber formations finally had fighter support that could take them deep into Germany and then escort them back to their bases in England. But still, it was flying combat was brutal. The 8th Air Force lost 26,000 men who were killed. And that's more than the entire Marine Corps fighting in the Pacific. And another 28,000 men were shot down and became prisoners of war. So being a combat airman in the 8th Air Force was the most dangerous duty assignment in the United States military during World War II.
Wow, I can only imagine having that assignment and just knowing that your chances of survival are pretty slim, considering all of the data that you just provided. But you go in there with your pride for your country and freedom in the world, I guess, and you go do your job. It's the only thing I could think of.
Well, they a lot of it had to do, well, I guess there's several factors involved, because it did take a lot of courage and guts to go up on those missions every day, knowing that the next one might be your last. And having, you know, some of your friends or other crewmen get killed on these missions. But, you know, from one standpoint, again, these guys were really young. And when you're that age, you kind of feel that you're invincible and, you know, it's you're not going to get shot down. It's going to be the other guy that's going to be shot down. Mm-hmm. But also the camaraderie of the crew. I mean, every crew member on that B-17 or any bomber crew was important. They all depended on one another. And so they didn't want to let their friends and their crewmates down. They had a job to do. And so they felt they had to do their job to protect the other members of the crew and their friends on the crew.
Mm-hmm.
And of course they were fighting for their country.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So it says here as well that they were in captivity avoiding captivity for months before they were able to get back. So what do you know about that part of the journey?
Well, I was on a bombing mission to Frankfurt, Germany on February 8th of 1944, where my dad's plane, the Susan Ruth, dropped their bomb successfully. But their bomb bay doors got hit by anti-aircraft fire, was termed as they called it flak. And they couldn't get the bomb bay doors back up. And as a result, that caused a drag in the plane. They lost airspeed and they fell behind the bomber formation that was heading back to their bases in England. And they were singled out by two German Focke-Wulf 190 fighters who came in like, you know, lions or wolves on prey. In the ensuing air battle, the Susan Ruth was shot down. Two of the crew were killed in the plane. The other eight bailed out successfully. But both those German fighters were shot down at the same time. One was piloted by Siegfried Merrick. His plane crashed and he was killed. And the other was piloted by Hans Berger, who was able to bail out and he made it through the war. And that's, if we can talk about that in a minute, because I actually found Hans Berger and interviewed him for the book. But the eight guys who bailed out, something different happened to each guy. Some became prisoners of war. Some evaded capture for a couple months, but then were captured by the Germans and killed. And then two of the crew evaded capture. One was my dad. After my dad bailed out, he came down in some trees right at the French-Belgium border, and his parachute got hung up in the branches, and he was dangling 20 feet off the ground and couldn't get down. But fortunately for him, a couple of young Belgian men, Henri Franken and Raymond Durvin, came to his rescue before the Germans got there. They helped him down from the tree, and that night they took him to the Durvin farmhouse. He only stayed there one night, though, because it was too dangerous with German patrols combing the area looking for him. So the next night, a Belgian customs officer, Paul Tilcan, who was a member of the Belgium underground, came on a tandem bicycle and took him to a safer location. And then after that, he was moved from place to place to place. How long he stayed in any given location depended on how long or how brave the people were who lived there. And how dangerous the Belgium underground thought it was for him to stay there. He might spend one night there, he might spend 6 weeks. So, and the people who helped my dad or other downed airmen for that matter were unbelievably brave because they risked not only their lives, but the lives of family and friends. Because if the German secret police, the Gestapo found out about it, they would be arrested, tortured, and either sent to a concentration camp or shot. And some of the people who helped my dad and other members of his crew did meet that fate.
Wow. Wow. I mean, to not really know where you are, to be in a foreign country and be traveled around, I mean, taken to different places, not know where you are. I mean, it's a 7 months. I can only imagine. So what was and I do want to get into your interview with the German fighter pilot, but at what point, was he returned? Did he get back to England or what happened? How did the Americans get back hold of him or what happened?
Well, like you say, it was very stressful for my dad. You know, his plane's attacked, it's on fire. He has to bail out, comes down in a foreign country, has no idea where he is, doesn't know what happened to his buddies on the crew, can't communicate with the U.S. military. And he's being helped by complete strangers, and they can't, and at the beginning they couldn't communicate because he couldn't speak French and they couldn't speak English. He had a little English-French dictionary in his escape kit that he could refer to. And any of these people could be a collaborator and, you know, sure, rat him out to the Gestapo. And there are several instances described in the book where he was almost discovered by the Germans. But finally, he got tired of hiding. Word came June 6th of 44, that the Allies had landed at Normandy. So he decided to get back in the fight. Unlike most airmen, before he went in the Air Force, he was in the Army in the infantry for a year. So he knew how to fight on the ground. And he decided to join the French resistance. The Belgian people that were helping him and hiding him tried to talk him out of it because it was way too dangerous. He could either die fighting against the Germans, or if they captured him, he'd be shot on the spot as a terrorist. But he convinced them to escort him across the border into France to hook up with a unit of the French resistance. They were called the Mackie, and the Mackie was made up of small independent ragtag guerrilla groups all across France. And they basically harassed the Germans. They would sabotage railroad lines, disrupt communications, assassinate German officers, attack convoys. And my dad fought with them for about 2.5 months. And again, in the book are described various encounters that his unit had attacking convoys, which was pretty exciting. And, you know, it took a tremendous amount of guts and bravery and courage for my dad to do that, because the smarter, safest things to do would have been just to stay put and stay hidden and wait for the U.S. armies to come up after D-Day to liberate that area. But he thought it was his duty to get back into the fight, and because there are, you know, lots of all these other servicemen fighting and dying for their country. And he said he thought it wasn't right for him to just hide from the war, but to get back into it. So I don't know how many people would have done that. I kind of doubt if I would have done it, but you never know until you're in that situation. But then finally, 7 months after he bailed out, when he was with the resistance, word came that there were U.S. troops in the nearby village of Trelon, France. So on September 2nd of 1944, he walked into the town in the town square, went up to an army major. Actually, it was a unit of Patton's Third Army, which had come up through France. And they interrogated to make sure he was who he said he was. And then he hopped a ride on a convoy taking German prisoners to Paris. And then from there, he got a ride on a transport back to England, where he sent a Western Union telegram to my mother saying he was fit as a fiddle, to keep her chin up and to bank the money, honey, he said, because he had all that back pay coming from the previous seven months.
Oh, wow. Yeah, because he was at work for 7 months. They just weren't paying him because they weren't right where he was. Oh, man.
He was just listed as missing in action.
He's MIA. Yeah, that's incredible, Steve. Wow. So he comes back. I can only imagine what your mom is going through at this point, right? I mean, thinking that you got to be assuming that he's gone, right?
Yes, because they were shot down on February 8th, and then she got a telegram from the War Department on February 23rd saying that he was missing in action and they didn't know what happened to him. And my other sister, Nancy, was born when my dad was missing in action. So there was my mother back in Pasadena, California, with a one-year-old, you know, girl, Susan Ruth, and then an infant little baby, Nancy, never knowing whether she'd see her husband again until she got that Western Union telegram. So that was a glorious day for my mother and my dad's parents and her parents and, you know, all the relatives back then.
Do you know how often they communicated prior to that? I mean, would that 2-week period before they even heard that he was missing in action been a little bit of a strain too?
Well, my dad and my mother wrote lots of letters back and forth while he was stationed in England before being shot down. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the things that really inspired me to write the book, is that my mother had kept all those letters that my dad had sent to her before being shot down. And after I retired, I had the time just to sit down and read all those letters. And it was incredible. My dad was really candid in what he wrote in those letters, and very detailed. He wrote about what bombing missions were like, what life was like in the air base, what life was like in England and London at the time, escapades of him and his crew. And reading those was fascinating. So those are really a treasure. But once my dad got shot down, you know, all of a sudden, no letters came. And then letters that my mother wrote to him that arrived after he was shot down were sent back to my mother. And so while he was missing in action, he did try to write a couple letters to my mother, but they never got to her. She didn't know anything until she got that Western Union telegram.
Wow. So he was trying to write to her while he's gone. You probably never found those, I would imagine.
No, I don't know what happened to those. You know, gave them to a courier, and the courier might have been killed. They could have been intercepted. Or just got lost. The other item that was really significant besides all those letters was a diary that my dad wrote while he was missing in action about his plane being shot down. That's absolutely riveting. That's in the book. And eventually that did get back to my mother. After the war, he had left that diary with one of his Belgium helpers, and they gave it to an army lieutenant who was stationed in England after the war. He was part of the U.S. military occupational forces in Europe at the time. And then he looked up my dad's information with the military records and found the address of my mother and sent that diary back to my mother. And I have it today. It's just written on numerous little short pieces of paper. Just handwritten in pencil. So that's a treasure as well. I'm really blessed that I know so much about my dad and what happened to the other members of the crew and all the Belgian people that helped him. Most people know very little about their World War II veteran.
Yeah, it's incredible. Once again, check out stevesnyderauthor.com. There's a section here with the letters where you can look at the different things that Richard was writing. I mean, the information here is incredible. That's amazing. So you talked about Hans Berger. So you were able to contact him. What was that like?
Pretty amazing. All my dad knew and all the Air Force knew is that my dad was shot down by two German Focke-Wulf fighters. And that's all I thought I'd ever know. But one day during my research, my wife, Glenda, said, well, why don't you try to find the German pilot just shot down your dad's plane? And I'm thinking, she has no idea what she's talking about. She's naive. You know, it'd be impossible to do that. He probably died in the war. It's 70 years later, you know, passed away by now. I can't speak German. But like a good husband, I did what she told me to do, and I found Hans Berger. And fortunately for me, became a translator after the war, so he speaks perfect English. And he gave me some wonderful insight that's in the book about what it was like to go up against the Air Force, the 8th Air Force. And I found out that the gunners on my dad's plane actually shot Hans down the same time that he shot my dad's plane down. So they shot each other down. And interesting enough, of all the people that are involved in the shot down story, Hans Berger's the only one that's still living. He's 98 years old now. He lives in Munich, Germany, and I've gone over there a couple times to visit him, and we've become friends.
Wow. That's just that is amazing.
Yeah.
How you can make those connections with people. Like I can only imagine what it was like the first time you were able to actually make contact with the guy. That's incredible. And his insights in the book are probably fascinating too, I would imagine.
Oh, yeah. I was so excited, you know, because at one point in history, my dad's life crossed paths with Han's life. And, you know, there was no other, World War II was the, you know, defining moment of my dad's life. And there's nothing that could match with that. So Han's is a part of my dad's story, of a part of his life. And he was pretty much just like the U.S. Airman. He was a young guy, 19, 20 years old, fighting for his country, trying to do a job and trying to stay alive. He said it was unfortunate that they had to be shooting at each other, but that was war. Han shot down 7 B-17s and 1 Spitfire during his military career, but he was shot down 3 times. And most of his friends were all killed in the war.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So when you were putting together the book, was the intent just to learn as much as you possibly could about the subject matter and share it with people? Or did you expect it to be this big, if you will, and as much of an educational piece as it is?
No. When I retired, my parents had kept a lot of material from the war years, and I just wanted to go through that and organize it and learn more details. And the more I learned, the more fascinated I became. But at the beginning, I had no intention at all of writing a book. I just wanted to find out more. And, you know, it just increased. Every time I found out a little something, it just increased my appetite to learn more. And so I just got into this big research project. I probably wouldn't have written a book, though, if it wasn't for two Belgian gentlemen, Dr. Paul Delahaye and Jacques Allot, who were young boys during the war and greatly affected by it. And later in life, they became local historians, and they interviewed all these Belgian people and members of the Belgium underground about events that took place involving my dad and his crew. And they documented their testimony, and they gave me unbelievably detailed information about events that would have been lost forever without their research. So I owe them a huge debt. They also supplied me not only with lots of information, but lots of pictures taken by Belgian people during the war. Also, a lot of the Belgian people who helped my dad during the war sent him pictures. And there's over 200 time period photographs in the books. You can visualize everything
that's incredible.
That you're reading about. But then finally, I just got to the point, and I guess it was about 3 years into my research, I just came to the conclusion that the story of my dad and his crew was so unique and so compelling that it needed to be told. So I decided I had to write a book. And because I had so much information and all these pictures and just the detail and document and everything. And the story is all based on firsthand testimony by either members of the crew, members of the Belgium underground, declassified military documents, war crimes report, Hansberger. What I added to the book was just a lot of historical information and anecdotes about and surrounding the war to put it in context and to give it background, and also to provide kind of a history of the 8th Air Force in the air war over Europe as a whole.
I always ask people, what's it like to write a book? But this book is just, this is different. This is a unique piece of history and educational material that I can just sense the passion about the whole subject matter. So I'd imagine it was pretty enjoyable to go through and just learn all about what happened.
Oh, and I continually learn stuff. I've been to Belgium 6 times. And every time I go over there, I learn a little new piece of information that I didn't know before. Unfortunately, Dr. Delahaye died in 2013, but Jacques Allot, who's 85 years old now, he's still active, and he continues to try to find people that might know a little bit of something that took place. So we continually do research, trying to go down rabbit holes, you know, to find any little tidbit of information, not only about what happened to my dad, but what happened to other people involved in the shot down story, mm-hmm. other members of my dad's crew, That there are other airmen from other B-17s that are involved in the story as well, and just so many members of the Belgium underground. And one thing that's fantastic about the whole thing is that there's so many places where, or locations where the events took place that are still there today in Belgium, where you can visit and actually, you know, see and visit where history took place. Houses where people stayed, farmhouses, places where Germans interrogated, a schoolhouse where they interrogated the airmen, a hut, a location of a hut in the forest where the airmen were hiding. It's just incredible that these places are still there, but where the events took place is right at the French-Belgian border in southern France is all rural farmland. So really things haven't changed in that area for hundreds of years. So nothing has been demolished.
I'm sure it's cool to go over there. It's a very Renaissance feel, right? I mean, I would imagine the architecture is just really interesting and fascinating in a place like that. I've been to Europe. I've been to a couple of different countries, but never Belgium. I have to check that out at some point. You said you've been six times though. So you're probably pretty comfortable over there at this point.
Well, Belgium is a fascinating little country. And, you know, especially if you're into war history, because Belgium's always been in the center of all these, you know, powers. And most of all the wars were fought on Belgium soil. So they have these monuments, the Battle of Waterloo, you know, during the Napoleonic Wars. Mm-hmm. That's a cool place. You know, World War I was there, the Flanders Field. They have a big World War I museum. And then World War II, of course, you know, the Battle of the Bulge was fought there. They have a Battle of the Bulge museum near Bastogne. And so it's a really unique little country. There's so much history that has taken place there. Actually, Hitler stayed after Germany invaded France and conquered France, or the armistice. Hitler set up a headquarters in Belgium in Brule des Peches, where he had his headquarters for a couple weeks. So they have all these bunkers there where you can go see there. So it's a fascinating look, besides all the places in the shot down story.
Yeah, and it's just like in the center of Europe in some way, even though it's over on the western side there. But at the headquarters of the EU and NATO, there's just a lot going on there. I mean, the history plus the present day, it's kind of a interesting information center. We'll have to check it out. Well, speaking of check it out, stevesnyderauthor.com, the author of the book Shot Down, incredible story. Steve, I could talk to you another hour or so about your dad's experience and what happened. I give you a lot of credit for diving into all this stuff. I appreciate the knowledge that you have. Is there anything else that I'm missing that really needs to be known that people will understand really about how, you know, the book and the story?
Well, there was no other event in history that affected more people than World War II. 60 million people died. You know, millions more were wounded. Millions more were left homeless and displaced. World War II changed the course of America and the world forever. And the brave young men who fought and died for freedom are without doubt the greatest generation, and their memory must never be forgotten. By my little tagline that I always use is, it is our duty to remember. And so that's something that we can never forget. You know, they say that if you don't learn from history or you forget history, you're going to repeat it. And I believe that firmly. So we always like have that. To learn from that.
If you forget history, you're going to repeat it. I'm putting that one in the quote book, Steve. Thank you so much for your time. What do you see? Last question. What do you see your efforts? How do you see them in the next couple of years or so? I mean, you continue to go on the speaking circuit and educate people. I mean, is that still passion for you?
Well, I'm still passionate about it. Of course, you know, in 2020, COVID hit. So I didn't do anything that year. And even this year in 2021, the first half of the year was, you know, still kind of recovering. And so there wasn't much happening. The second half of this year, I've traveled quite a bit and started back up again. So having that like year and a half lull kind of reinvigorated me and had a little respite or rest. So I'll keep doing this for another probably couple of years. We'll just have to wait and see if I get tired of traveling or whatever. But I plan to be pretty active this next year. In 2022, I have quite a number of things I'm starting to line up now. Like I say, it's a passion, and I love doing it.
Awesome. Steve, thank you so much. Wish you the best travels. We all kind of want to get out and get back to traveling around with the COVID. Hopefully, you'll stay healthy and keep being able to spread this awesome message of courage. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Bob. I really appreciate you having me on your show, and have a Merry Christmas.
You too. Bye.
Steve is like an encyclopedia. He was quoting off dates and times and locations like it was nothing. I really admire his passion for his father's story. And not to mention the story of the people his father served with. His website alone is fascinating because of the documentation of what happened. It's a shame the pandemic has limited his ability to travel and spread the message of courage like he had previously. But it seems he's a little reinvigorated right now and rested to get out there and share the stories again. Steve's an author like no other that we've interviewed before on Speaking of Impact. This is a history lesson, not a self-help book, or a shelf-help book, as Robert Riopelle would say. However, you can certainly help yourself with this text. Next week, you're going to hear from Don Cody, and he's going to talk about how you got to lead yourself first. It's an amazingly important concept to consider because it takes courage to be a leader. And that is true for all forms of leadership, including self-leadership. Shot down encourages us to be courageous. And we all may not be wartime pilots, but we got to show up for our families and for our companies, for impact projects, and for fellow humans. We just got to be courageous. Ed Everts from episode 59 talked about bravery and leadership. Be brave. Fight for something, stand up for a cause, take up a purpose, and lead yourself and inspire other people to do the same. The foundational and most important ingredient of impact making is courage. I pray that your foundation is deep and forever strengthened. I want to hear your story of courage, and maybe you'd be the perfect guest for a future episode or the right person to contribute to the e-impact blog. You know, share that story of courage with the other impact makers out there. Hit me up at BDeepa on Twitter or IG in the DMs. Would love to hear from you. Have a great rest of your week, and I will talk to you next time. Together, we can make the world a better place. See ya.
Thanks for listening today. If you'd like to connect with Bob, visit bobdepasquale.com. Tune in next time for more inspiring stories. And remember to like and subscribe so you don't miss an episode.